This is Megan Anderson.
And I'm Jenna Myers.
We've been hired by the International Space Alliance to work on this assignment together. We're calling it the Colony Files. This is our first submission.
It's been 2 months now since an illness plagued the first colony on Mars, killing almost half the crew.
And the news covered the events, but we'll be digging deeper, compiling interviews with those involved in the Mars 2060 mission and hearing firsthand from the survivors.
My journey to Mars begins tomorrow. I'll be traveling with the emergency transit vehicle, which is bringing more food and more medical supplies and personnel to help with the aftermath of this disaster. Our trip will take 10 months. And then once we're there, I'll begin my interviews with the survivors.
Shortly before Jenna lands on Mars, I'll leave to begin my trip around the globe interviewing astronauts who are currently on their way back to Earth from Mars. I'll also be speaking with the employees at Ground Control. The following submissions are recordings for the private ISA reports. The Colony Files.
This is Jenna Myers. This is an excerpt of my interview with Mission Commander Dan Whitfield, recorded at his office on Colony 1. He discusses planning the Mars 2060 mission, the rock formation discovery, and the first days on Mars. Okay, we're recording now.
Okay, is this fine?
Yeah, you don't have to talk loudly, Dr. Whitfield. The mic will pick up your voice even at a whisper.
All right, and you can call me Dan.
Okay, thanks, Dan. Well, I say let's just dive in. So, back in 2036, the first manned mission went to Mars, and they made their initial discovery of that mysterious rock formation. At that time, were you one of the skeptics or one of the believers?
Oh, believer. Absolutely. I mean, yeah, I understood why some people thought it could have been naturally formed, but I did not believe that. Staring at the photographs of the rock formation and studying the way rocks appeared to have been cut and perfectly fit together into this strange little structure, I just wanted it to be proof.
And every time a mission went to further the investigating, were you becoming more interested in going yourself?
Oh, definitely. All of a sudden, the idea that there had been life on Mars was a very real possibility. We were on the brink of the largest discovery known to man, and each mission seemed like one more stepping stone to get us there. But it takes a long time to plan and set up a mission the size of Colony 1. Sending 50 people through space with the hopes that we will survive indefinitely on a completely uninhabitable planet that's over 200 million kilometers away from Earth, that is a difficult task, to say the least.
Right. When you finally arrived on Mars, what was your main concern? The dig site or the colony?
Oh, definitely the colony. Of course, I could not wait to get to work on the dig site and see all the rock formations myself, but none of that would have been possible if we couldn't figure out how to live safely and survive. And we almost didn't.
Speaking of that, I'm really interested in the last transmission you sent to Earth when the solar conjunction began.
I don't remember exactly what I said. Not all of it came through from what I understand. Do you know much about solar conjunction?
I know that it happens every 2 years and that communication between Earth and Mars is not possible during that time.
Okay, so that's right. Now, the cause of that is that Earth and Mars line up across from each other on opposite sides of the sun, and it could not have happened at a worse possible time.
I have the transmission with me, and I'd like to play it for you if that's all right.
Okay.
This is Mission Commander Whitfield, Sol 670. I don't know if this will reach you, but our conditions here are worsening. Since my last transmission, Dr. Hamilton has reported that the condition of all 31 of her patients is declining rapidly. She doesn't think they will survive, and we still don't know what's causing their illness. Our situation is becoming grave. We don't have much time.
At the time of this transmission, did you have any idea what was going on?
No. But I knew that we were in very serious trouble. I mean, so many people were sick, and we couldn't figure out what it was or where it was coming from. And our second ship was getting close to Mars, bringing us new crew members, food, and medical supplies, but we knew they wouldn't be able to help at all until we could contain whatever was slowly destroying us. You have to understand that during every mission, we expect to have issues. They're a certainty, but we have the most qualified experts coming up with every possible problem that can occur and the solutions to fix them. So generally, when we encounter an issue, we don't panic. When we first started experiencing this issue, it was a minor concern, a tiny blip on my radar. Up until that point, I was proud of how things were going and of what we were accomplishing.
A lot of people really loved watching your video updates on the news. The crew seemed really close.
Good. That took a while, but we found a routine and we really did figure out a way to work really well together.
Was everything set up for you the way you wanted it?
The robots we sent here before us were capable of incredible things, and they did everything we programmed them to do with just perfect precision. The temporary habitat, looked just like the models we had made. It was so much to take in when we landed. I took my first steps on the surface of Mars, and it was better than any Christmas morning I can remember. The audio in my headset was functioning just fine, but with every step I took closer to the main entrance, all I could hear was my own breathing. And I remember walking into the airlock with so much anticipation. I mean, I had spent years developing this project. It was strange to finally be at the front door just waiting to get in. Have you ever dreamed you were in a place that seemed completely familiar at the time, but then you woke up and you realized you had never been there in real life?
Yeah, I think I know what you mean.
Well, that's similar to what it felt like. Somewhere in my mind, these things felt familiar. Yet at the same time, it was all so brand new.
Was it a difficult decision to join this mission?
You know, not as much as you'd think. I've always wanted to travel into space. I mean, it was a dream of mine since I was a kid. And my wife shared the same dream. And it was not a tough sell to get her out here either.
I heard she was one hell of an engineer.
Yeah. She was the best.
I'm really sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Do you hear from any of the crew members who went back to Earth?
A few. The others, look, I can't blame them for wanting to move on from all this. I think they just want to forget.
Are you trying to forget?
It'd be a waste of time and effort. Seems to me that some things float freely in and out of memory, and others are burned in for all eternity. And I'd say that the Colony One disaster is the latter.
This is Megan Anderson. This is an excerpt of my interview with psychologist Sarah Smith, taken at the International Space Alliance headquarters in Washington, D.C. Sarah discusses the screening process for applicants and the psychological issues they needed to watch for during the flight and on Mars. What was the selection process like for choosing the Colony One team?
Right, well, there were a lot of factors we were looking for in candidates for this mission, but to put it in a nutshell, we needed people who got along with each other. You know, picture going to live somewhere for at least 3 years with the same 49 people. I mean, in the not-too-distant future, we're hoping to have families there too, so the population will grow and grow, but if you're the beginning of the colony, you're going to be pretty close to that group of people. It's like the ultimate small town. I mean, you can imagine how fast gossip gets around.
I'll bet tensions can get high at times, too.
Yeah. But that's why hierarchy was important. You know, we needed people who could be both leaders and followers, so that if something happened to the leader, the next person, you know, they had to be able to step into their position.
I'm guessing people who have been in the military would fit a lot of these qualifications?
Yes, exactly. I mean, they make really good candidates, as well as researchers who've participated in the simulated space missions. I mean, we're looking for confident, adventure-seeking individuals who can be emotionally independent.
What do you mean by that?
Imagine that you've signed up to be part of the first colony on Mars, and you're going to be gone from Earth for at least 3 years. I mean, not to mention that half the team volunteered to never return. So the average person couldn't handle that. I mean, even the above-average person would have trouble. And so we needed people who could manage their emotions. You know, they needed to be able to sense when they were getting homesick or anxious or depressed, and then be able to take steps to take care of themselves.
You're basically talking about the perfect person, right? I mean, super smart, sociable, and always seeing the glass half full.
Pretty much, yeah.
The other half of the team who weren't staying forever, did they choose how long they got to stay on Mars, or did the ISA make the decision for them?
It was a little bit of both, actually.
Okay. So what were the psychological problems your team was looking out for that are specific to space travel?
Well, they're similar to problems that you would find with submariners or Antarctic researchers. I mean, one of the big psychological issues is something that we call the long stare. The Russians call it asthenia. It comes from confinement. People can lose focus and they end up staring off into the distance for long periods of time. It can cause severe anxiety, and then that's where mistakes happen.
I can imagine. Mm-hmm. Was homesickness also an issue?
Oh yeah, it's common. You know, and everybody deals with it differently. Some people jump further into their work or read books. Working out is big, taking a nice run on a treadmill. And if they need to see views from home, they all have their virtual reality headsets.
There was word that you guys had voice recorders in every room on Mars. Is that true?
I mean, the people who signed up knew that we were going to be listening. I suppose it's a little like signing up for a reality show. You know, I mean, we also had cameras hooked up in many of the rooms.
What were you looking for?
They have speech and optical monitoring technology, and that, you know, helps us detect changes in behavior patterns. Basically, they're warning signs that someone wasn't doing as well as they were letting on.
You mean like they're hiding signs of depression or something like that?
Exactly. 5 months into the flight, one of our chemical engineers received word that his brother had died from a heart attack, and he was only 22. That sent him spiraling. He couldn't stop thinking about his mom having to take care of all the arrangements alone, and of course he missed his brother. And the big problem was he didn't want to let anyone know he was struggling. So we made sure we had a psychologist to speak to him when the incident happened, but he worked hard to show that he was okay. And then he began lashing out at people, and eventually he stopped eating.
How did you handle that?
We get to know everyone well. I had spent a lot of time with Igor prior to the launch. I know that this might sound strange, but I knew that I needed to record his brother's memorial for him. So I went to the service and shot the whole thing from start to finish. It was a beautiful service. Of course, it was in Russian, but you don't need to understand the language to understand the person.
You flew to Russia? You could have just asked someone there to record it.
I could have, but it was important for me to be there, you know, so that I could report back to him. I could let him know that his mom was okay. I could tell him that when I went to the reception at his mom's house, that she had this recent picture of his brother that she'd framed. And he was wearing Igor's ISA jacket that he'd given him before the launch. It was really important for me to be there. We're all a family. You know, those of us that are on the ground here, too. We're in this mission together.
I had no idea. You guys went so out of your way to take care of your team.
Team first, always.
This is Jenna. I met with William Bex in the rec room of Colony 1. He's a mechanical engineer. He discusses his spacewalk during the flight to Mars. I've been told everyone just calls you Bex. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am. I haven't gone by William since I was about 5.
I haven't gone by ma'am ever.
Yeah, sorry. You can take the boy out of the South, but...
But the South follows you all the way to Mars? Those are some relentless manners.
Don't I know it.
So, I wanted to ask you about your trip out here. I flew on the X2 Transit, but you were on the new Mega Transit vehicle.
Oh yeah, she was an impressive spaceship.
And you had to leave the ship at one point during your flight, right?
Yes, we had a radiator fail. But look, it's not something you can just leave and hope it works out. It does have to function correctly. We left Earth's orbit without any issues and continued that way for several months, and that's when the radiator malfunctioned.
Before you went out, did you feel confident you knew how to fix it?
I mean, I had the computer readings at my fingertips, and I was familiar with the issue being reported. The thing is, a computer's a computer, and I needed to see it myself.
Were you looking forward to the spacewalk?
I mean, it's a phenomenal opportunity, something very few people get to do. But that's because it's incredibly dangerous. If something goes wrong while you're out in the breeze, everyone on board has orders to cut you loose. No one is permitted to risk their safety or the safety of others in order to save you. I knew that if I went out and, for whatever reason, couldn't get myself back in, that would be the end. I'd float off into space, all alone, and eventually suffocate.
What was it like?
I was surprised at how I felt once I heard the airlock close behind me. Even though Commander Whitfield was out there too, it was strange and unnerving.
So you guys were both sent out to fix the radiator?
Sort of. I mean, you never go on a spacewalk alone, and the commander's done several before. He stayed closer to the hatch.
What did you do?
Well, first, I gave myself a moment. I heard Commander Whitfield in my earpiece almost immediately. He was checking in, and I said back that I was fine, 5x5. All he said back was Roger. Before I reached out to grab the handrail, I looked down at my tether and followed it back to the bulkhead. I knew that I was connected, but I needed to be sure before I pulled myself forward. There are handrails all around the exterior, and I used them to guide myself along the spacecraft. Every time I grabbed a new section of handrail, I paused to pull on it a bit just to make sure I had it in my grasp. Our AVA suits are bulky, and everything just feels different. Every couple of minutes, the commander would tell me everything was looking good. It was good for me to hear his voice. I finally reached the radiator, and it took longer than I would have liked, but I did get it fixed.
Must have been such a relief.
It was, for a brief moment. I decided I needed to look around. It occurred to me that I had finished the job, I was okay, and I might never get this chance again, so I should give myself a moment to take everything in around me. I turned, and that was it. It only took a tenth of a second for my mind to start reeling. I was looking at a star and trying to wrap my head around how far it was from me. I would have to travel thousands of years to ever reach it, and I'd be dead by then anyway. Staring out into space, this endless void, this darkness began to feel like a tangible thing. It was closing in on me. It was everywhere. I couldn't see the Earth anymore. There was nothing to remind me of who I was or what I was doing. I lost my sense of reality. It was too surreal. And the next thing I knew, I couldn't feel the handrail in my grasp. I was gasping for air and frantically trying to turn around to see the ship, but I couldn't. I started screaming and reaching behind me, but I was too far. Panic doesn't even begin to describe what I felt. I heard the commander say, "Bex, Bex, you're all right. You're still attached. You're all right." I'm sure it's difficult for you to understand, but I couldn't comprehend his words. I could hear him, but I couldn't see him. I was looking at my empty hands, and then the darkness surrounding them that stretched as far as I could see. He came in again. "The tether, Bex. You're okay. Take a breath. You're gonna be okay." I looked down and saw it. Literally my lifeline. I reached out and grabbed the strap. Hand over hand, I reeled myself in toward the spacecraft. I reached the handrails and I saw that I was only about a meter away from the hatch. I pulled myself up against the exterior and I closed my eyes. I stayed there, clinging to the rails. Then I heard the commander again. He was telling me to get back inside, but I couldn't do it. Getting back inside meant letting go of the rails and risking drifting away again. I just shook my head no. The next thing I knew, Commander Whitfield shouted, "You have to do this. let go of the damn rails, and get back inside. I'd never heard the commander yell like that before. He told me later that he said several other things to me that I hadn't responded to. I think I was just so paralyzed by the fear I checked out. I never heard any of it. I mean, thankfully he yelled or I may have never have gotten back in.
Do you still think about it, the spacewalk?
I try not to, but I've made my peace with it. I do still dream about it sometimes, though. But you know, I also dream about pitchers of sweet tea and biscuits, so maybe that evens out.
This is Megan from the ISA headquarters speaking with Colin Kepper, who was part of the archaeological team on Colony 1. He talks about the 9-month flight and what the morning of the launch was like for the crew.
They fixed a big breakfast for us. Bacon, eggs. I couldn't keep any of it down. The main thing I remember from the launch is taking my last deep breath before getting on the ship and realizing, hey, Colin, you're never going to smell fresh earth air again. Ever. From here on out, we be manufacturing our air. It's not like we'd ever be able to step outside and just take a deep breath, huh? And Earth, it becomes this thing. You know, it's hard to explain, but I mean, it's more tangible when you're looking at it as a whole instead of standing in your yard looking up. I didn't realize how emotional it would be saying goodbye to Earth itself.
And what were the 9 months like on the flight?
Not gonna lie. As poetic as saying goodbye was, the rest of the trip was brutally boring.
Were there any problems on the spacecraft?
There were some interesting moments. Some people were really having trouble adjusting to the lack of personal space. Everyone had their days. Unfortunately, I bumped into one of the chemists on one of her bad days and knocked her juice out of her hand, and that was enough to set her off. And she did her best to knock me in the jaw, but she barely tapped me. And that sent her spinning backwards. It's not exactly easy to articulate your movements in zero gravity. And I went to catch her, but missed and ended up smashing into the wall. All this orange juice just came squirting out in bubbles because this drink packet had floated between us. And we were just bouncing into each other. And we were laughing so hard by the time the juice started floating out. It was hard to settle down. Yeah, most of the trip I'd rather forget, though. The day in, day out, the food. Awful. Their main concern was nutrients, not flavor. And the toilets. The jacks are much better now than they used to be, but I've never missed gravity more than when I was trying to relieve myself. At least you get bars to hook your feet under if you need to sit down. And there's a belt you put over yourself, like when you're on a roller coaster. Oof. Keeps everything strapped down. 0G's a bitch.
And how did it feel to finally land on Mars?
Strange. I was happy to be on land, but also scared out of my mind. There was no norm when we landed. It was all new.
And were you looking forward to getting to the dig site?
Oh, sure. Look, that's what kept me sane on the flight. We've been studying and researching everything we could for years leading up to the trip, and it's not like we were learning more on the flight, but we continued to meet and talk about the plan, go over the schedule. When we finally got there and moved into the hab, we all took a field trip to the dig site.
What was that moment like for you?
It was like meeting the Pope. Like you'd seen him on television and read about him, but when you actually shake his hand and talk to him, it's nothing like what you'd imagine.
I'll have to take your word for it.
Okay, astronauts get to meet some interesting people. You'll just have to trust me. It was a holy moment. And scary. Enough to put your heart crossways.
Why was it scary?
Because we were on Mars. And that rock formation was no joke. When I saw it with my own eyes, I had no question in my mind that something created that. It was too precise. The size of the rocks, the angles, it was clear to me that those angles were cut and fit together.
But why was it scary?
The unknown can be scary, can't it? If this rock formation was indeed made by some form of alien life, then that would mean we're not alone. What else could be out there?